This is JS Party, your weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. Merch alert! We have restocked, so if you've been waiting for a JS Party shirt in your size, now is the time to hit up jsparty.fm/merch before they sell out again. Thank you to our partners for helping us bring you world-class developer pods each and every week. Fastly.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. Okay, hey, it's party time, y'all.
What's up, friends? I'm here with one of our good friends, Firas Abukadije. Firas is the founder and CEO of Socket. You can find them at socket.dev. Secure your supply chain, ship with confidence. But Firas, I have a question for you. What's the problem? What security concerns do developers face when consuming open source dependencies? What does Socket do to solve these problems?
So the problem that Socket solves is when a developer is choosing a package, there's so much potential information they could look at, right? I mean, at the end of the day, they're trying to get a job done, right? There's a feature they want to implement. They want to solve a problem. So they go and find a package that looks like it might be a promising solution. Maybe they check to see that it has an open source license, that it has good docs. Maybe they check the number of downloads or GitHub stars. But most developers don't really go beyond that. And if you think about what it means to use a good package, to find it, to use a good open source dependency, we care about a lot of other things too, right? We care about who is the maintainer? Is this thing well maintained? From a security perspective, we care about, does this thing have known vulnerabilities? Does it do weird things? Maybe it takes your environment variables and it sends them off to the network, meaning it's going to take your API keys, your tokens. Like, that would be bad. The unfortunate thing is that today, most developers who are choosing packages and going about their day, they're not looking for that type of stuff. It's not really reasonable to expect a developer to go and open up every single one of their dependencies and read every line of code, not to mention that the average NPM package has 79 additional dependencies that it brings in. So you're talking about just, you know, thousands and thousands of lines of code. And so we do that work for the developer. So we go out and we fully analyze every piece of their dependencies, you know, every one of those lines of code, and we look for strange things. We look for those risks that they're not going to have time to look for. So we'll find, you know, we detect all kinds of attacks and kinds of malware and vulnerabilities in those dependencies, and we bring them to the developer and help them when they're at that moment of choosing a package.
Okay, that's good. So what's the install process? What's the getting started?
Socket's super easy to get started with. So our whole team is made up of developers, and so it's super developer friendly. We got tired of using security tools that send a ton of alerts and were hard to configure and just kind of noisy. And so we built Socket to fix all those problems. So we have all the typical integrations you'd expect, a CLI, a GitHub app, an API, all that good stuff. But most of our users use Socket through the GitHub app, and it's a really fast install. A couple clicks, you get it going, and it monitors all your pull requests. And you can get an accurate and kind of in-depth analysis of all your dependencies. Really high signal to noise. You know, it doesn't just cover vulnerabilities. It's actually about the full picture of dependency risk and quality, right? So we help you make better decisions about dependencies that you're using directly in the pull request workflow, directly where you're spending your time as a developer. You know, whether you're managing a small project or a large application with thousands of dependencies, Socket has you covered, and it's pretty simple to use. It's really not a complicated tool.
Very cool. The next step is to go to socket.dev, install the GitHub app, or book a demo. Either works for us. Again, socket.dev. That's socket.dev.
It's me, Amal Hussein. If I sound different, it's because I've lost my voice. 2.5 weeks in Europe means like I've been doing a lot of talking loudly, and I haven't had a chance to get a travel mic either. So please bear with my audio. Forgive me. But it's okay because we have an amazing guest who's going to make up for my crappy audio and my crappy voice. With me on the show today is Nick Nisi. Welcome, Nick.
Hoi hoi. Hi, Mel. How's it going?
Hi, how are you? Are you excited about today's topic?
I am very excited. And for the record, I think you sound great.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you. This is like my Steven Seagal voice, you know? It's all husky and But anyways, our guest today is Saran Yitberek. Hello, welcome, Saran. We're so excited to have you.
Hello, how are you?
Hey.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Super pumped.
Yeah, I feel like you need no introduction because you're like internet famous. And I don't know, I've been a fangirl for a long time. And I remember the first time I actually met you in person was, first and only time I think I met you in person was at All Things Open a few years ago. And I was just like, like, oh my God, wait a second, you're East African too? Because my parents are from East Africa. And I immediately was just like, okay, what's your story? I just like totally got up in your face and I apologize for that on air.
That's okay.
Not every day you meet another like East African woman who's kicking butt, you know? But anyway, so for folks who aren't familiar, Saran, why don't you tell us about yourself?
Sure. So I am a developer, podcaster, founder. So I got my start in coding about 10 years ago, learned how to code on my own for a couple months, then went into a boot camp, went to the Flatiron School, graduated from that. And when I did that program, for me, it was really eye-opening because what I really gathered from that is just the power of community and how incredibly valuable it was to learn to code with other people. And I realized that if you wanted to learn how to code and you didn't do a boot camp, because boot camps are expensive, like back then it was $11,000 for me. And now I look at tuition and it's like $15,000, $20,000, sometimes $30,000 depending on the program. It's really pricey. And, you know, back then there were no, you know, payment plans, there were no loans, there were like you had the money or you didn't. And even I didn't have the money. I had to borrow some of the money from my mom to help me, you know, pay for that program. And so I felt like if you didn't have a boot camp, it was really hard to find that support system that to me was so crucial to me learning how to code. And I wanted to create a community for people who were learning. And so I started doing these Twitter chats. This was back when Twitter chats were like all the rage. Everyone had one. And you picked a hashtag. Our hashtag was CodeNewbie. And I would tweet out questions every, you know, Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern time. And I would ask, you know, what are you excited about? What are you learning? Where are you stuck on? And people would respond and kind of talk to me and really talk with each other and get to know each other. And there'd be a lot of just this love, you know, in these Twitter chats and this support and this just really good vibes all around. And I did that week after week. And after about 6 months of doing that, I said, you know, I think we have something here, but I really want to dig deeper into these stories. I really want to focus in on these developers and inspire people in a deeper way. And I thought podcast, audio, that's the right way to do it. That's a great medium for that. And so we launched the CodeNewbie podcast. And I think it was maybe 2 months into doing the podcast that I got an email from a company who said, hey, I'll give you $200 if you run an ad on your show. And I was like, whoa, I can make money from this. Yeah. And so that was really the first time, you know, I started thinking of it not just as like this fun side hustle I was doing while I was a developer full time, but actually had the potential to be, you know, a sustainable business. And so that launched, you know, just my thinking shifted from that, from like, how do I make this into a proper, like a media company? You know, it's kind of funny because I guess content creator was the right term, but I never thought of myself as a content creator because my content was never centered around me. You know, like it was never about me being in front of the video camera or me talking about my opinions. I wasn't trying to be a thought leader. It was really about shining a light on other people and bringing people together. So I thought of myself as more of a community / media company than a content creator. And so we did the podcast, and then over the years launched another podcast called the BCS podcast, which was me and a good friend of mine, Vaidehi Joshi, who did this series on computer science. And we basically turned her blog post into an audio format, into a podcast. And that went really well. That got really popular. We launched a conference called CodeLand that we do every year. We had meetup groups all over the US. And so just trying to listen to the community and figure out what's needed and what people wanted support on, and trying to, you know, turn those into some type of content, some type of product to help people, has been kind of the name of the game. And so I ran that for 3 years part-time while I worked as a developer, and then 3 years full-time. And then I sold it a couple of years ago to Dev2, which was renamed Forum is the official company name, but they run the Dev.2 platform. And after I sold that, I thought, you know, I think I want to stay on the business side of things. Let me go to business school so I can learn business things and I can learn the proper way to do business. And I got into Columbia and did the executive MBA program for 2 years. And I think it was like 6 months into the program, I was like, I think I just want to start another business. And so after making this, you know, spending a ton of money on this degree that I didn't really need to start a business, I ended up launching Disco as part of a class that I took, this entrepreneurship class. And Disco was meant to be audio courses. So it was taking my love of podcasting, taking in my love of audio. And audio at that time, if you remember, Clubhouse was like popping, you know, they raised like billions of dollars.
Bajillions.
Bajillions of money. I don't know where it went, but they raised it. They had it. And so I was really kind of writing
about really
that.
Expensive headphones, you know?
Yeah.
$10,000 headphones for every employee. You know, that's where it went.
Oh my goodness. Is that true? Is that really what they did with it?
No. Please don't make up a rumor.
They probably did.
Definitely.
I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know where it went, but it went somewhere.
Yeah, I'm just trolling, girl. Seriously.
But yeah. And so I was, you know, riding the wave of audio and really believed that audio had a future in education and in leveling people up. But I wanted to test the idea. I wanted to make sure this was kind of the right move. And so I did a pre-order. So I had a landing page, and for 3 weeks, I sold these courses at, you know, a slight discount, and just wanted to get a sense of like, are people into this? Are they interested? What do they think? And so I launched it, and I had almost 500 people sign up for it within a couple of weeks. And I thought, great, that's like great traction. Good solid early sign. Let's get to work. Let's build this. And to build it, I needed to raise some money because I needed to hire producers to help create all the content. And luckily, since I'm a developer, I could build the web app, and I needed some help with mobile. So I wanted to hire mobile developers. So I needed some cash. So I thought, let me raise like a little pre-seed round, $500,000. I gave myself 3 months to raise it. And then within about 3 or 4 weeks, I had commitments of over 3.4 million. And I was like, okay, people are into this. People are, you know, serious. Investors are excited. But the way that investment works is, you know, you can't necessarily take all the money that you get offered because then you have to give up a ton of equity. So I negotiated with our lead investor and ended up taking a little over $2 million and took that in. Got to work, hired producers, hired mobile devs, built out the app, built out the content, took a couple of months, launched it to our eagerly awaiting customers, and then I heard crickets. No one hit play, no one logged in, like a few people did, but basically no one did. And I was confused because we had all these people, and a lot of them were actually paying every month as a subscription because we sold a subscription to our, like, you know, future library of content. And no one was canceling. Like, no one emailed me to say, like, you know, give me my money back or cancel my account. They just weren't using what we were producing. And it was very confusing and very discouraging. And, you know, I interviewed about 100 of our users, and I said, you know, like, tell me what's going on. You know, why are you doing this? Or why are you not doing this? Right? Like, why aren't you, you know, using the content? And basically, it came down to the simple fact that we weren't solving a pain point. We weren't solving a problem for people. We were a gym membership. We were a nice to have. We were an aspirational product. People loved the idea of what we were doing. People liked the idea of taking audio courses. But at the end of the day, they didn't need us.
And what topics were you covering in those audio courses?
Technical topics. So we did like a lot of machine. So this is before like, you know, ChatGPT and all that popped off. But
I remember the machine learning courses. Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, we did machine learning was one of our big ones. And then we transitioned to some like leadership type courses. So like conflict resolution and management style and like how to have one-on-ones and those types of, you know, professional topics that weren't necessarily technical that we thought would be a little bit easier to consume via audio. And so we did that. And so when I realized that it wasn't working, you know, I said to my investors, I said, you know, I don't think this idea is going to blow up because if people who already paid for it aren't using it, then, you know, that's kind of it. And I asked for their permission to pivot and to, you know, try out other ideas. And they were fine with it. And so for the next, like, 2 years, I've been heads down trying to find the right idea to work on that is validated, that has legs. And so I've gone through over a dozen ideas. I've done so many landing pages, interviewed hundreds of people, just really trying to do my due diligence. Because to me, the opportunity to, you know, raise money, especially as a Black woman, is like, you know, unheard of. And so I really take this opportunity very seriously. And I take this money very seriously. And I want to use it very wisely. And I want to make sure that whatever I build is validated and I have conviction over it. So I've been been just really meticulous about figuring out what to build, how to build it, and making sure I have I'm in the right space. So yeah, that's what's been going on.
Yeah, no, I mean, oh my God, girl. Whoa. All right. So we're going to have to like unpack all this awesomeness. I'm like, so can we just start with just like acknowledging like, okay, that you're clearly, you know, a serial entrepreneur. And I really love the approach that you took initially around, let me gauge interest before I invest, you know? And then I think that's it's kind of unfortunate that like, you did the due diligence of like making sure that people wanted this thing.
I thought so.
And then you went and built the thing. You know, I have to wonder though, because, you know, the past few years, as you're well aware, like it's been kind of a crapshoot on many layers, you know, especially people's behaviors changed so much. And so I'm just wondering how much of this do you think was actually a timing problem for you?
It's interesting because I feel like I raised money. I had the right idea for the right time. Because, you know, I think that people were interested in Disco and the audio course idea for two reasons. Number one, because it was audio and a lot of investors who weren't in on the Clubhouse round were looking for their audio play. Like I had so many investors say to me, like, I'm bullish on audio. Like that was the line, like I'm bullish on audio. And so there was a lot of interest on like, you know, I didn't get in on the Clubhouse round. I need something in my portfolio that says audio. So I think that the timing, I don't really know why audio was so popular in during the pandemic, or at least the first part of the pandemic, but it really was. And I think that me being kind of on trend made me just a very exciting investment to invest in. And then two, the fact that I'd already sold a company and already kind of proven myself as an entrepreneur made it an easy yes for a lot of investors.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the Columbia MBA, I don't know whether you finished it or not, but that doesn't hurt either.
I did, yeah.
That doesn't hurt either, yeah. You know what I mean?
No, yeah, that's true. That's true. It was actually funny because I raised the money during my MBA program. I was in the second year, and I remember like we had a block class, which is when you have class from like 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday. It's just a 1 week long course. And I remember because of the pandemic, it was all Zoom calls. So I was, you know, in, you know, Zoom University on one screen with my like professor going, like taking investor pitches and, you know, going through my pitch deck on another screen, you know, trying to like multitask and do it all. But I do also think that the timing of the pandemic worked in my favor because all pitching became remote, which meant I could do 20 pitches a week. You can't do that before the pandemic because I would have had to fly to San Francisco, get a hotel, spend my money, you know, on that flight, seeing maybe one investor per day. You know what I mean? Like, it would have been just highly inefficient. But because everyone was not expecting that and people were doing pitches and were raising rounds over Zoom calls, I was able to raise a round very quickly. And just, I mean, I pitched over 100 investors in like 2 months. You can't do that if you are not in a remote world, right? So I think that the timing of that really worked in my favor.
Yeah, I mean, so I think for me, I have like this personal goal of, you know, going back to school and getting an MBA from MIT. I want to get their executive MBA. And that's to help me with that like grown-up network. Like, I mean, I feel like I have a huge network within tech, but I don't feel like a lot of my tech friends are fully grown-ups, you know? I just want some more grown-up friends with money because, you know, I definitely want to do some more kind of social entrepreneurship stuff later in life. Like I have a whole second career that I want to start. And so it's just very inspiring to see that you've taken that route and that you've managed to kind of still keep a foot in this community of, you know, being embedded in the developer space. So like fantastic. And so we invited you here to kind of talk about your next project, right? Which we know, spoiler alert, is called Not a Designer. I think three or four R's, I don't know, on Twitter. But that was smart.
I couldn't find it.
That was awesome. I loved it. On Twitter, it's multiple R's. But on the internet, it's not.
I think it looks so obnoxious, but I didn't know how else to do it. So that's what we got.
I love it. I mean, the way I pronounce it is like not a designer. You know what I mean? It's just
so. There we go. A little sass.
Right. But on the internet, it is notadesigner.io. So for folks who want to follow along. So can you tell us about what this project is, Saran, and what inspired you to create it?
Sure. Yeah. So this project is really exciting for and I started for two reasons. The first is, you know, I'm trying to figure out Disco and trying to figure out where to put my eggs and how to best use this money that I raised. Because, you know, because I stopped the audio course venture within 4 months of raising money, I have most of the money left over. It's sitting in a bank account waiting to be deployed. And so I really wanted to be responsible with that money. And so, you know, my strategy has been doing
another reason why everybody should give Black women money, right? Like, you know, that's like.
Because we take it seriously.
This is not a game. Move. Yeah. That money would have been so gone for anyone else. Like, that would have been, yeah, really, it would have been like, you would have been raising like four more rounds, you know, before you decided to
honestly, that's one of my things that it's one of the things I'm most proud of is how responsible I have been with the cash. And all my investors were like shocked that I had any of it left over after 4 months. And I was like, it's only 4 months. You should have a lot of it left over.
But what about your foosball tables, you know? $10,000 headphones, you know?
Exactly. I need my headphones. I'm an audio company. I need my headphones. But yeah, and so I really wanted to be responsible with it. And so I have been doing a lot of user interviews, a lot of just talking to users, because my big thing now is I want to make sure I'm solving a problem. That's the lesson I took away from the first time. That's what I want to get right the second time. And so in the process of doing that, I feel like doing user interviews has been an extremely draining process. I've cycled through, you know, being extremely hopeful and optimistic to being super depressed and just very like frustrated with the whole process and burning out, and then getting optimistic again, then getting really burnt out. And I've just been riding that roller coaster for the last 2 years. And I decided to do something different this time, where I said, instead of me trying to get to know my user through customer interviews and through, you know, talking to them, what if I became my user? So what if I picked an area that I'm interested in, picked a user base that I'm fascinated in, and I just did the job and learned firsthand what my pain points are? And so newsletters is an area that I've been really interested in for the past, you know, year or so. One of my biggest regrets with Code Newbie, I mean, it worked out in the end, but one of my biggest regrets in Code Newbie is not doing a better job of having a mailing list. We had a newsletter, but we didn't really take it very seriously. It was okay, but it wasn't a focus for us. And, you know, when people ask me, you know, how big is your community, it was really hard to quantify it, because we have, you know, 100,000 on Twitter, we had another, you know, 20,000 on Slack, we had another 10,000 on Instagram. Like, it was just all over the place. So we didn't have a place that we owned that was our own place. And a mailing list solves that problem, because that's the only platform that is actually yours. You own that relationship. And so I really believe in newsletters. We just didn't do a good job of it. And I always said that if I ever launched a new product, a new company, new content, that I would have a mailing list. Like, I would have a newsletter and really focus on that. And so I really believe in the newsletter format. I think it has a ton of potential. And I've seen over the past 4 or 5 years, it's gotten really popular, especially with, you know, Beehive, and ConvertKit's been around for quite some time. Substack, you know, popped off, I think, in 2018, 2019. And so I've just been really interested in that space. And so I said, instead of trying to go out and interview newsletter creators, why don't I just start a newsletter? And so I said, let me pick a topic that I'm actually passionate about, that I would actually want to write about, even if no one read it. You know, what's the thing that you would do when no one is looking, when no one's paying attention? And I've always loved design. I've always been fascinated by it, but I've never taken a formal class. I've never been trained as a designer, but I've always wanted to be better at it. It's always been a topic and an area that I wanted to just to be good at. And it's the one thing that I would do for free, just for fun, because I just really enjoy it. And so, you know, building the landing pages on my own ideas has been probably my favorite part, because it's just fun to build landing pages. And so I thought, well, what if I teach design to developers as a student myself? So it's me going off, spending 20, 30 hours learning a topic, learning, you know, leveling up on a particular thing, and then turning what I learned into a step-by-step breakdown, a walkthrough, and then taking that and writing a newsletter and targeting it to developers who also want to level up when it comes to design. So that's the topic of it. So it's called Not a Designer, because I'm not a designer. I'm a developer trying to learn design skills. And that's what the focus of the newsletter is on. And it's been amazing. It's been such a great way to learn things myself and actually be a better designer, which is one of my main goals. But it's also been a really great way of surfacing problems that newsletter people face in terms of growing a newsletter, writing, and I have a marketing person that helps me. And together we've gone through and written out all the different problems that we face, all the different issues we have, and trying to see, is there a product for newsletter creators that we can turn our problems and our issues into? So it's worked out really well.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's fascinating. I feel like you're like, this is like such a pragmatic approach to creating a business. You know, it's like you really kind of are going, I feel like there's something here that we should coin. I don't know what it is, what the term is. It's like, it's like the scientific method for tech entrepreneurship, you know, something like that. You know what I mean?
Because they always say that the best ideas are the best problems to solve are your own, right? Start with your own problems and figure that out. And I'm like, I'm doing all right. Like, I don't really have many problems. Like, I don't have many problems that are tech startup material. You know what I mean? Like, I like the tools I use. Like, I'm doing just fine. So in order to surface the problems, I needed to go through an experience that allowed me to, that exposed me to certain problems firsthand, you know? And so I think that, and this is the advice that, because I have a couple entrepreneurship friends that are kind of in the same boat of trying to figure out what their first product is. And another model that I think is a good, you know, potential way to surface other ideas is the agency model of trying to solve a problem for customers manually and charging them, you know, a fee to solve their problems, you know, on a just on a one-to-one basis, understand what those problems are, understand what your clients are facing, what issues they are, and then seeing, can you turn that into a product? Can you turn that into a SaaS? So I think that's another way to kind of approach the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always really liked that model because I feel like a lot of really successful, especially on the B2B side, a lot of very successful B2Bs come out of people that were, you know, solving these problems internally at their company, and their company wasn't giving that problem enough energy or love or space, or they're like, mm-hmm. I can solve it better. You know, this could be a standalone product, or, you know, we're solving this big problem here. Let's create a service and share it out so other people don't have to solve this solved problem, you know? So yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. So I don't know, Nick, so mm-hmm. would you use that? Not a designer? I mean, do you have these needs where you're like, hey, I'm a developer? Actually, so we haven't even surrounded. We've talked so much about the I think the inspiration. We haven't really dug into like, what is not a designer? Like, you're basically teaching.
Yeah.
So what's like the elevator pitch?
Yeah. So it's design content for developers. Okay. So each week I pick a particular, like a really granular thing. So for example, one week, like last week, I did one on color contrast. Accessibility is a topic that I've been very bad at as a developer in prioritizing. It's something that I know I should do. I know it's the right thing to do. But for frankly, reasons I don't really know, I can't really explain. It just hasn't been top of mind for me. And I really wanted to use the newsletter as an opportunity to dig in and to learn more about the topic. So we had, I think I wrote like a 2000 word issue on color contrast. And it was basically me saying, as a developer, I have not prioritized color contrast. Here's why you should. Here's what makes it maybe a little bit difficult, or at least it's not even hard. It's just intimidating because we don't know about it. Here are some examples of what a poorly contrasting graphic looks like for someone with low vision. And I use a simulator to kind of illustrate those points. And then I say, here's, you know, what the WCAG, which is the, I forget what it stands for, but it's the authority on accessibility guidelines.
No, it's not the WCAG. It's like another
web
like
content accessibility guideline.
Yes. Yeah. That one.
That's so neat. So Nick, yeah, back to you now. So Nick, you're a developer. Would you...
Yeah.
I feel like you need Saran's product. But.
I do. Yeah, it's funny because I saw this go by on Twitter probably a few weeks ago, and then it's immediately appealing to me, and also like really highlights what I feel is like a big shortcoming, because I'm primarily a front-end dev. And so I spend a lot of time, you know, making designs come to life with, you know, from Figma. And I can do that pretty well, but I basically just like, I'm like, okay, whatever. And if I push back, it's because some tool like Axe Developer Tools or something told me to push back. But I really don't have that design eye. And so this is immediately appealing to me just because I feel like as a front end developer, I should know a little bit more about it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And then I love the titles of your newsletter, like one being I Need My Space. A scientific approach to line height. I was like, oh, yeah, sign me up for that. Another one is, are these colors contrasting enough? And then like in parens, probably not, you know? So just all like really great. How to pick a font, or is it a typeface? Like, honestly, these are things like, I don't even know. I mean, honestly, I'm so embarrassed to say this.
I learned the difference in that newsletter. So yeah.
I was going to just say, thank you, Saran. Like, I'm so embarrassed. Like, I'm like, I don't even know what the difference is. Jeez, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that one in particular because it's like, yeah, I never know what font to pick, or really, I can kind of tell you the difference between like serif and sans serif, and that's it. But then like, you're like, or is it a typeface? And I'm like, what is a typeface? I have no idea.
Yeah. And I think my favorite newsletter title has to be this one, which is like, when is tighter better? The art of letter spacing. I was like, okay, Saran, I see you. You know, no, this is fantastic. I mean, this is exactly the kind of like really focused, you know. So first of all, like in the information age, right? Like in the age of ChatGPT, like good content is like king, you know, in the sense that like the thing that really distinguishes newsletters, and, you know, people want focused content from an authority that they can trust. And I feel like, you know, check on that front. And so tell us, like, what's that like, you know, so this is a new newsletter. I feel like we're kind of catching you a little bit on the earlier side of your hockey stick, but you have had a decent amount of growth and traction so far.
It's been all right. Yeah, it's been just over a month. I think October 10 was the first release that we had. And so we have a little over almost 850 subscribers at this point, which I think is good. Yeah, it's so interesting because we've been doing, as my marketing person, Arena, we've been doing a lot of research on, you know, what does growth look like in a newsletter? What are the different, you know, ways to get people to subscribe? Where do new subscribers come from, et cetera? And what we have been reading about is that it is truly like all about social media. Like if you aren't able to activate a social media following, if you aren't able to convert them, you're just going to have a hard time. That's where a lot of new subscribers come from. And so what's been really interesting is with the change in algorithm, like it has affected my engagement and my reach so much, like since Elon took over, frankly. It was so much easier.
Isn't it crazy though?
Wild. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's people with like 10,000 followers are having trouble getting likes or attend, like people like reading their tweets. Like, I'm just so surprised, you know?
I have like 37,000 followers, which sounds amazing. And then when you look at my engagement, like if I get more than 7 retweets on a tweet, I'm having a great day. Like, it's so hard. And I don't feel like what I'm tweeting is that different. Like, I don't feel like I was tweeting things that were drastically different from, well, now I'm tweeting more design stuff. But even before that, like it's really fascinating to figure out. So now I feel like, you know, we're playing this game of what does the algorithm want, you know, and what is the feed looking for? And it's a game I don't want to play, but I kind of feel like I have to, because how else do you spread the word? You know what I mean?
It's like the YouTube thumbnail problem, you know, it's like that like thing where all these creators have to use like the titles that they don't like and thumbnails that they don't like because they need to feed the algorithm. Yeah. Like, you know, they need to feed the beast. It's so sad. It's so sad. Yeah.
And so I feel like there's a formula out there for my newsletter. I just don't know what the formula is. So just trying, and also just taking it, you know, I don't find social media creation to be the fun part. Like, I really enjoy making the newsletter. I think it's a lot of fun. It's really interesting to do all this research, and it's really fun to turn it into an issue. And I love the writing process. And another thing that I've been experimenting with recently is video. So taking it's really fascinating how you can take a newsletter that you spent, you know, 20 hours writing, and then you can convert it into like 3 40-second videos.
Like TikTok videos or like shorts, basically, essentially.
Yeah, like really short. Yeah. And so we've been experimenting with those and trying to see if that helps with reach, if that helps with retweets. And we've only done like 2 videos, so it's still too early to see. But yeah, there's a lot of just experimentation on figuring out how to grow that has been a lot less straightforward than I thought it was going to be. Like, I thought, you know, hire a marketing person and then all of a sudden you'll be fine. But it's been, and especially with newsletters, I think that the more people create newsletters, my suspicion is that the more not wary, but the more reluctant people are to sign up for new ones. And so I think that I think you really have to earn a subscriber these days in a way that maybe you didn't like 5 years ago.
You do. I mean, you absolutely do. Yeah. I mean, yes, this is like fascinating, honestly. I mean, like you're hitting on so many interesting topics, like how to scale an audience, you know, in an ever-changing landscape of like, you know, where like everything around you is shifting. I mean, that's really challenging. Especially when you're already kind of trying to find your voice and find your audience in this new business. Like, that alone is challenging. But then, like, not having kind of a solid footing on the marketing front is tough, you know? Like, you have to play like Lara Croft from Tomb Raider is like, you know, chief marketing officer, you know? Like, you have to just be ready to, like, be ready to pivot and do all kinds of things.
I also feel like developer Twitter has really gotten hit the hardest, because that's the one I feel like really has bifurcated into Mastodon and into Blue Sky and the other ones as well. Like, it's just really tough.
How are you dealing with that proliferation of social media? Because you have some audience that's on TikTok, which has like a growing, like tech TikTok is growing, and you know, and then you have Blue Threads, you know, which I think is like the serious Twitter now, like, you know, as in like CNN will spend advertising dollars on Threads versus like doing it on X, you know. And then you have Blue Sky, which I don't even know. I mean, I don't even know. Like, how do you even get an invite to that thing? Like, I don't even freaking know.
I was on it and then like my I got a new
don't
phone
care enough.
And yeah, yeah, that's
I personally
how I feel.
Don't care enough. Like I've no interest
I was
in signing
so
up.
Excited. Yeah, I was so excited when they first launched. And then I just really didn't like my feed and I just didn't like what was being posted. And I was just kind of like, I don't really want to be on here anymore.
Same. But I love being able to use your domain name as your username. That's the best.
That is really cool. That part's really cool. Yeah, because I can just use just my first name, which is really exciting. But yeah, but they like logged me out, I think when they switched from staging to production or something. And then like I just never logged back in. I was like, well, that was fun while it lasted. But Mastodon, I just don't understand. And it's just too much. I don't even remember if I have a Mastodon account.
I mean, I think you're just highlighting that the state of kind of social media as far as kind of like the quote unquote smart social media, right? Like smart content, like not just like Facebook posts, you know, it's kind of broken right now. I keep hoping that someone will come and fix it. But like, I don't know if that's coming. And so I think businesses have to just adapt to this new world, you know, sucks, right? It's like a hard pill to swallow. But I think I'll kind of share some insights for what Changelog does. You know, so Changelog is like, we're not going to try to get audiences to come to us. We're just going to go to where the audiences are, you know? So they'll just like, okay, we're going to post our podcast or we'll post little snippets on YouTube, we'll post them on TikTok, we'll post them on Insta, you know, which is kind of a lot of work, but I feel like there's maybe an opportunity here to kind of have a company be that distributor, right? Like, you know, somebody needs to sell the shovels in this broken world. And I feel like somebody please create an app where, you know, that works well, that where you're not going to get rate limited, where you post once, you know, and post everywhere.
Like, it reminds me of, do you watch The Office?
Yes.
Or when I guess.
Yeah.
Remember Woof?
Yes.
Remember the app that, was it Ryan? Yeah, I think it was Ryan. The temp that he created where you send a woof and a send a woof sends the same thing via like phone call, text message, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest. Like it just sends the same thing to all the and that was like his big idea. It didn't go anywhere in the movie but or in the TV show, but maybe it'll go somewhere now.
but we need a woof, don't you think?
We need a woof.
We need a woof. But yeah, so getting back to kind of not a designer and like this new problem that you're solving, which by the way, just congrats, 850 subscribers is nothing to sleep at, like within a month in 2023, especially. So congrats. Also, the content is fantastic. So everyone listening, please subscribe. Like it's a solid read. So tell me, like, what's the response been from developers that are just like, oh, okay, I'm having like an aha moment? Like,
yeah, it's been really good. The thing about newsletters that I've learned is that people are not in the habit of replying to a newsletter. So I say in my newsletter, you know, tell me what you think, hit reply, blah, blah, blah. But most people, like I've had people who subscribe to newsletter, instead of replying in the newsletter, they'll like DM me, which I think is kind of funny. I'm like, you could just hit reply. Like I read everything, but they'll DM me instead, which is sweet. But no, I've gotten really good responses. I've gotten people who've said like, this is the stuff that I've always wondered about that I never like had a chance to learn or didn't get a chance to focus on. Like I'm leveling up. But the two messages that really made me feel really good, like I was on the right track, were one, in response to my color contrast issue that posted last week, I got an email from someone who's colorblind. And he was just so thankful that I shone light on this issue and on this topic that, you know, so many people kind of overlook or don't really value or don't know about. And he was like, you know, as a colorblind person, like people implementing these changes and people taking accessibility seriously impacts the way I use the internet and impacts me day to day. And it's really great that you're doing that. So that was really validating, just hearing someone from the community, you know, acknowledge it. And then similarly, there is an accessibility engineer named Todd Libby on Twitter, and he was a really big help in me writing the accessibility issue. He recommended a couple tools for me that I checked out and incorporated in my issue. And I sent him the post afterwards, you know, privately, just to say, you know, how'd I do, you know, that I do right by you. And he was like, I'll give it a 10 out of 10. And it was really validating for him to say that, you know, as a newcomer who doesn't know about accessibility and learning it for the sake of writing the issue, you know, that I did a good job with that topic and that I addressed it well. So he gave me some really validating feedback, which was just really good to hear.
Yeah, no, I mean, congratulations. students, really.
You mentioned you approach this like and teach it from the perspective of a student yourself. So I'm curious, like, how you do you have like a formula that you go through for these topics on like how you're going to research and discover the proper things that you want to highlight in the articles?
Yeah, the research process is the longest process. I feel like if it's researched well, then the writing comes easy, right? So the research process is very messy. It's like, you know, anywhere from 10 to 12 hours probably on average of just researching. And that depends on the topic. Like, I think the contrast one took a little bit more time because I really wanted to make sure that I, you know, did a good job on that. And that just took a lot more. That one took a lot more experimentation because I wanted to try out all the tools. I tried a bunch of accessibility tools and picked the ones that I thought would be easy for developers to use and implement. And so, yeah, my research process is super messy. I start with a Google Doc and I'll just copy and paste just little tidbits of information with links of where they came from into this really, really long Google Doc until I kind of feel like I started forming a picture. And then I'll kind of let my questions lead the research process. So, okay, like for example, with the accessibility one, my first question was like, what does low vision even mean, right? I hear the term low vision. I don't actually know what that means. What is that? So there's a lot of research into visual impairments and how low vision doesn't mean one thing. It can mean a wide range of things. People can be impacted very differently and low vision can mean different things to different people. So it was just a lot of just understanding the problem. And then it was, okay, so contrast is one of the problems that people with low vision have. Okay, what does contrast even mean? What is a contrast ratio? So then looking up what that means and what those terms and definitions were, and then saying, okay, but like, what does it look like? You know, okay, sure, contrast is bad, but as someone who, you know, wears glasses and that fixes my visual impairment, I don't have an appreciation or understanding for what low contrast, like how it would affect me. I just have no sense of that. And so I thought if I'm able to show my readers what low contrast looks like, that would be really powerful. So then I looked into simulators. I spent a good chunk of time just looking up simulators. And that's where Todd and another developer, Graham, came in handy. And they pointed me to a couple of good resources. And so a lot of it is just me coming up with questions, doing a lot of really, really messy research. And then at some point, maybe like halfway through the research, I'll start writing and I'll start saying, you know, okay, here is my starting point as a developer. Here's the question that's kind of going through my mind. Let me start writing until I realize that I have another question that I need to research. And then I'll pause, go back to researching, and then I'll fill in that blank, write out that piece. Then I'll find another gap in my knowledge, fill that, go back to writing, and just kind of like ping-ponging back and forth until the piece is done.
I love that. I mean, I feel like you're just kind of doing the hard work that everyone's too lazy to do. And so another reason why everyone should subscribe, because like you're like,
it's, well, a shortcut.
It really is. It's kind of like, okay, well, I'm a developer and I, you know, I really should know about these things in order to kind of like level up my ability to deliver, I would say, better software, right? And more accessible software, better, more just software. And then, you know, it would take me like basically like 2 weeks to do like a level up on this one thing. And, but you know, I can just, my cheat is to just like read Sarah's newsletter, right? Because you're approaching it from the perspective of a developer, these are like all the questions that like people have, you know what I mean? It's like people actually have these questions. And so it's like, okay, well, like, let's go explore them. And then let me explain them to you in a language that you understand. Let me, you know, use analogies that make sense to you. So I really love it. So hopefully, can't wait to like see the hockey stick of Not a Designer kind of continue. But what do you see as the end game for this platform, right? So what's the grand vision for Sarah?
Yeah. So for me, the newsletter is an opportunity to understand what it takes to build a newsletter and what it takes to be a content creator and to use that information to build a product for content creators. Oh. That's my end goal. And so I don't plan on like monetizing Not a Designer. I don't plan on like creating a course or anything like that. I am interested in partnering with other content creators. So I reached out to a couple people who do have design courses or who've written design books and said, hey, I would love to, for free, you know, I'd love to feature your work and, you know, kind of use your expertise to to teach, you know, my subscribers things that you know, and then in the process, you know, give you some extra views on your course and your book as well. So I'm definitely interested in partnering with other content creators who might have paid products. But as far as not a designer, I plan to just keep writing and keep growing it and just using it as an opportunity to figure out how do you use social media to market it? How do you use different tools? The world of social media is very interesting because there's a lot of tools out there. There's a ton, but there isn't anything that we've seen that is particular to newsletter creators. And so that's a space that we've been kind of focusing in on a little bit is making a little, like we've tried using so many of the scheduling tools, so many of the AI writing tools and figuring out, you know, what's missing from those tools? What do we wish existed and what could we possibly create that might be, you know, better or at least serve our needs? And then figuring out, would it serve the needs of other people and what would that look like? So those are kinds of the things that we're trying to figure out.
Given the state of everything and kind of thinking about, you know, GitHub Universe was just last week, OpenAI had a big announcement. I'm curious if like AI plays a role at all in content creation for you today, or if you see any plans for that. Or how you approach that topic.
Positively or negatively, yeah. You know, I'd be curious.
Yeah. Positively or negatively. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so I'm really fascinated by AI. My husband is actually, he's chief AI officer at his startup, The Story Graph, which is a competitor to Goodreads. It's the number one competitor to Goodreads. They have millions of people who use their app to help track their reading. So he's been, you know, exposing me to a lot of AI stuff, a lot of machine learning, a lot of models. And he's like very excited to try out the latest and greatest. And he's always keeping up to date with this information. So I get a lot of my news from him. But it's the kind of thing where I've tried using it. I haven't used it to create a newsletter, but I have tried it as to generate just other pieces of content. And what I found is that it has actually been really helpful in creating our social media content. So we will, you know, feed it pieces of our newsletter and give it a prompt and try to get it to come up with tweets for us to schedule, and we'll still modify it. We'll still, you know, improve it and kind of
give it the human touch.
Give it that human touch.
A little human sprinkle, you know, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
That'll be like the new norm. It'll be like, it's not fully AI, you know, it's just, you know.
Yeah,
just,
yeah. You
know, so it reminds me of this famous artist who, like, he's a potter. And so he makes these perfect pots from hand. Like, you don't even think that a human being made them. They look like machine made. And then at the end, he'll just put a thumb in it somewhere. You know, he'll just like ruin it, quote unquote. And he's like, yeah, now it's got the human touch, you know? So
now it's human. Wow.
Now it's human. Yeah. So I love that. So I feel like we need to kind of like, yeah, we need to, AI just spits out this perfect thing. And then we need to kind of mess it up a little, you know, give it that human flavor. You know? Throw in some punctuation mistakes and, you know, use the wrong spelling for here and there.
Yeah,
you know?
Use the wrong hashtag. Yeah.
Just, you know, that's something.
Funny. I haven't been doing like content creation with it or anything. But one thing that I've been using it for somewhat day to day, not really day to day, but occasionally is like, instead of just like asking it to produce something for me, I kind of use it as a way to get around the blank slate that I'm looking at. And
exactly.
Yeah. I just use it as exactly. Like, this is my end goal. Ask me a series of questions that help to stimulate my mind. And then that kind of helps.
Tell me a story that'll make me want to do work.
That's
to
funny.
Be a good story.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
funny. Yeah, like it was funny because, like I said, I have a marketing person that does the social media for me, and I'll like review it and kind of give it a final stamp of approval. And to really appreciate that most people don't have a marketing person and most people are doing it on themselves, for themselves, I said, you know, let me try doing like my own social media for like one issue and just see what that's like. It was the worst. I hated it so much. I couldn't believe how much I hated it. Like just because I've already done the work. You know what I mean? Like I've already done the work of writing this amazing issue that I'm super proud of. And now I had to like finagle it and you know, short form it and repurpose it.
Yeah.
It was just such a chore. And I just hated doing it so much that really the way I see AI is using it as a really good first draft. You know, I see it as a good, just give me something to work with, because it's so much easier to edit social media content than it is to come up with it. And even with Arena now, like she'll, you know, present me some social media and I still end up like editing it a little bit and kind of like freshening it up or just making it a little bit closer to my voice. And so we use ChatGPT to come up with some of our initial drafts, and it's just so much easier and so much just so much less painful to work with a first draft, even if it's not a great first draft, than it is to start with a completely blank slate. So it's been that's kind of how I see the role of AI. It feels like I can't imagine using AI to write the newsletter. Like the newsletter is, it's too long. It's too many pieces. It's too complex. I just don't see any time soon of that happening. I can see using it to come up with a title, which I haven't done yet. Maybe I should, to come up with a title or like a subtitle.
I don't know, Saran. Your titles are pretty great. I don't think.
You're yeah.
Okay. We need those human sprinkles.
We need those human. Okay. I'll keep that one. But for social media, it has been helpful.
Yeah. No, that's great. Sounds like you're using AI. I mean, personally, the way like I've been using it, but also just I feel like, you know, not just because I'm doing it this way, but I do feel like it is the right way to use it. It is an accelerator. It is an enabler. It is not like a takeover. You know what I mean? And it just should help us do more with less, you know, especially for a startup such as yours. Well, I mean, it's not a startup, but it is a, I don't know, what would you call this actually? An initiative sounds way too boring.
Content, I guess. Project. Yeah. Project. I don't know.
I think you're building a community, though, don't you? So I to some degree.
You know, that's been the interesting part of figuring this out is where does the community come in? Because I don't think that newsletters are necessarily primed for a community. I think that when people experience a newsletter, they feel like it's a very much a one-way communication tool where they will consume that information and they just kind of go about their day. You know, they're not necessarily, it's not like Twitter where there's a favorite button right there, there's a retweet button right there, there's a reply button. You know what I mean? It doesn't, and no one sees it, right? Like I'm the only one who sees it. So I think the readers don't know who they are. They don't know each other. So community has been kind of a thing that I thought would be more organic, but really hasn't been. It really has been a broadcast tool more so than it has been a let's get together around this topic tool.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So I've always liked it when I see folks integrate things into their blog where they're like, discuss it. And then their discussion basically is like a Twitter. It basically starts something on Twitter, you know what I mean? Or remember back in the day, there was that other one. What was it? It was like that embedded comments that were like, discuss.
Oh, yeah, discuss.
Remember
yeah.
discuss? Yeah, like I really like that, you know? That was kind of pre-social media or you know, early social media days that was popular.
Yeah.
There's something about wanting to talk about it. I mean, and so I get this way with film and television where like especially when I nerd out about a show, I'm like, I need to talk about it. So I will go on to, I'll watch the deep dives on YouTube. I'll read the comments, like go to Reddit. Like, you know, there is this, I want other people's perspective on the thing that I just saw. So, you know, so I say, Saran, don't fully write off community yet is what I'm saying, you know?
Okay.
I think there's a space there for people to want to say, oh, yeah, I love this newsletter. And like, what about this? And what about that? And, you know, wanting to kind of have engagement and discussion with you.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's a certain number of subscribers I have to reach before you get to that critical mass. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I would say yes, because JS Party, for example, we have tens of thousands of listeners. But I mean, the folks who we interact with on a weekly week, like our fan girls and boys and thems, like they are the people that like, you know, like they're not tens of thousands of people, right? It's like dozens of people, right? For example. And so, you know, so it is one of those things where, yeah, you might just need to just hit critical mass, but, you know, and looking forward to you hitting that critical mass, hopefully.
Me too.
Yeah. And so it wouldn't be fair for me to like have you on this show and not double click into entrepreneurship because quite frankly, like you are a serial entrepreneur and I really do want to like hear about those experiences from you. But I want to pass the mic to Nick. Nick, what do you want to know about Saran's entrepreneurship? Or her serial entrepreneurship, I should say. I think we're going to see a lot of things from her. So
yeah, definitely. And I don't know. Put me on the spot, Amal.
I know. I'm sorry.
I don't, this is another thing that's kind of like the not a designer, you know, my perspective on that in that I feel like I should know more. I feel like I should know more about entrepreneurship.
Maybe that's your next thing, Saran, you know?
Not an entrepreneur, not a founder. Not a founder. Oh, that's a good one.
That's a hockey stick right there, you know, if I ever knew one. Yeah, I mean, so think about it this way, right? So I'm fascinated by the fact that as engineers, we're all kind of like one, I don't even know. We're like one commit away from becoming an entrepreneur, like in the sense that we do enable businesses, right? So we are the shovels, we are the product, we're everything, right? And so the fact that like you can be 60 years old, be working out of your parents' basement and like create something that millions of people can use. I mean, you know, that's the story that got me into tech, you know, personally. Mm-hmm. It was like the ability Same. To kind yeah. of make a difference and be you're the only obstacle to yourself, right? Very different than other industries that require certifications, regulations, degrees, networks, blah, 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 right? There is some level of meritocracy in tech where like, you know, you are, if you're good, like you will make it, you know?
Mm-hmm. You can't be a 15-year-old surgeon.
Yeah, that's true.
Exactly.
That's true.
For good reason. But yes, that's exactly yeah. right, Nick.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating. Yeah. We're all kind of, I feel like, in that sense, like we're all like budding entrepreneurs, right? Not everybody makes the leap, but you did. And so what was the driver for you? Like what drove you to like to say, like, yeah, you know, I want to be on the driver's seat, right? And not on the creator's seat.
Yeah. So for me, I mean, I feel like I've been completely brainwashed, to be honest, by, you know, YC and startups and venture capital and like just that whole world. And I feel like when I think about what is the most exciting, most interesting journey I could have, I feel like the answer is entrepreneurship. I feel a huge amount of luck and privilege in being who I am and being born to my parents and being, because I'm an immigrant, right? I'm from Ethiopia. I was born there. And my dad literally won like a literal lottery to come to the US. And then my mom and I followed a year later. And so a lot of my family is still back home, you know?
So my mom got her citizenship through lottery as
yeah,
well. My
yeah.
mom actually, my mom studied here in the 80s. She was on a student visa. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, then we moved to Dubai, which is where I grew up. I was born in New York City, very thankful and blessed to be a first generation American. And yeah, my mom, like when we were living in Dubai, she like got her like permanent, like, you know, she won the lottery and like that's mm-hmm. how she became a citizen, you know? So I know what that's like. And I know how it's a big deal. Like it's a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like life changing.
Yeah. And so I feel I feel this huge responsibility to make the most I can out of this opportunity. And I feel like the thing that has the most upside is starting a business. Like if I think about the potential for accomplishment, for achievement, for success, for money, for, you know, for influence, like I feel like being a founder and building a really successful business is like the ceiling is there is no ceiling for what that could be. And so even though it is the harder path, even though it is the riskier path, it feels like the one worth pursuing. And I think that a big part of that is just being an immigrant and feeling like I really want to take advantage of the opportunities that my family didn't have, my, you know, people growing up didn't have, and just really wanting to make the most of the opportunities I have.
So well said. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we got to wrap it there because that was like the biggest mic drop that I'm like, I don't even know what we can, like, what else we could say to top that, you know? Okay, maybe lessons learned. How about this? We'll close out with lessons learned. So dear Saran, what lessons have you learned from all the projects that you've worked on and hardest lessons to learn? I'm curious, like the ones that, yeah, you didn't expect to learn, but you did.
Yeah, the hardest lesson that I learned is that pre-orders don't mean what they think you mean. That was probably the hardest lesson. I think that excitement over a product and solving a problem are two very different things. And for me, people saying like, oh, this is really cool, I would buy it, or even people, and that was a thing, right? Because I knew not to expect much from people saying they would buy it. But I really thought that if they did buy it, that would mean something. But even that ended up being a false positive, right? And so I think for me, the thing I'm really trying to focus on is how do I make people's lives easier? How do I solve a problem versus how do I get people excited about an idea? Because excitement, it can be useful information, but it can also trick you into thinking something is going to work when it's not. But I also do think that there's part of it where there's kind of only so much validation can get you. At some point, you do have to just build it and see. And I think the smaller you can build it, the better. The faster you can build it, the better. The fewer resources you can use, less money you have to spend, the better. But ultimately, like there's nothing quite like giving people a chance to take you up on your offer to see if what you have in your head actually makes sense and if it's gonna work.
So well said. That's like golden advice right there. You know, one of my favorite songs in the world. It's called the Sunscreen Song. We'll link it in the show notes. There's this line. It's not really a song. It's basically just like a guy talking to like, like there's music in the background, but it's basically a speech. It's like a speech to like young people. And there's this line about advice and advice being like recycled nostalgia.
Oh.
And so you should always kind of take it, you know, in that sense. But I also just, it's also be like, be careful about whose advice you take, right? And I take that very seriously because it's like, well, don't take advice. For me, like my personal rule is like, I don't take criticism for people whose advice I wouldn't take, you know? So if I don't take your advice, I'm not taking your criticisms. And so, but I would say for you, I would take your advice. I would take your criticisms. I would take it all, Saran, okay? So thank you for sharing that priceless advice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nick, to put you on the spot again, any final thoughts or anything before we kind of wrap up here with our guest?
I'm just really excited about the work that you're doing. I look forward to Not a Founder and learning from that. But in the meantime, thank you for helping make me a better designer.
Yeah.
You're
legit,
welcome.
Legit. All right. Well, with that said, Saran, so where can people kind of follow you, get in touch with you? How do they subscribe to the newsletter? Tell us all the things.
Yeah, sure. So to subscribe to the newsletter, it's notadesigner.io/subscribe. So feel free to check it out. You can check out our testimonials and our past issues there and see what we're all about. And if you like what you see, would love to be able to share my content with you and have you subscribe. As far as reaching me, my DMs are open. Twitter is the best way to reach me. It's just my first name, last name, Saran Yitbarek. That's probably the best way to reach me, and it's the same on pretty much all the socials except Blue Sky, which I'm not really active on, but it's just at Saran on there. But yeah, and if you're ever in San Diego and want to get coffee, feel free to ping me and I'll meet up with you.
Yeah. Oh man, that's like a coffee date that I would love to be a fly on the wall for. All right, well, Saran, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for gracing us. Best of luck with this project and all your future projects, right? I think it's like a wild loop that we're in right now.
A wild loop.
And whenever you do start Not a Founder, just remember, like, it started here first, everybody, okay?
Gotcha. It started here first. Gotcha.
There's just a little attribution line on the bottom on the about page.
Okay.
All right, everyone. That's our show for this week. Thanks, Saran. And we'll chat with you all next week. We've got a really exciting show. I'll let Jared tell you all about it because I have no voice. Love you guys. Peace.
Next up on the pod, Yuna Kravitz is back, but she's not defending her front-end feud championship quite yet. Nope. Next week, she's talking with Nick and Amel all about her favorite new CSS, Bits and Bobs. Front-end feud will return in January, though, and yes, Yuna will return as well. Can anyone dethrone our three-time champs? I guess we'll have to wait and find out. Thanks once again to our partners, Fastly.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. And thank you to our Beat Freak in Residence, Breakmaster Cylinder. Did you hear us interview BMC on Changelog and Friends? One listener called it one of the all-time best episodes. All right, that's it. This one's done. But come back and party with us again next week.